Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The truth is the most convincing story that maps onto reality, and that's why the central narrative is falling apart.
Right now in the United States, people should not be walking around with masks.
We must see the central narrative for the fiction that it is. We are Americans.
While elections are sometimes messy, this was a secure election.
The founders began the fight for human liberty and self-governance, and it's up to us to finish the job.
I tell you what. We are in a truth emergency right now.
This is the end game.
It's Thursday, March 28th, 2024, the 1163rd day of dystopia. I'm your moderator, Chris Paul. Let's be reasonable. A warm welcome and hello to all of you listening to the podcast on the day of its release. The only way to do that is by becoming a paid subscriber at imyourmoderator.substack.com. You can do so for as little as $50 a year or $5 a month, and in doing so, you will be supporting me, the work I do, and this show as it expands. And if you can't or you simply don't want to, continue listening to the podcast for free a couple days later on a wide variety of podcast platforms and, of course, Rumble. All I ask is that you share it with your friends. You can find the links to the podcast, the writing, the social media, and the merch site by visiting linktree.com/I'mYourModerator. Now, yesterday we left off talking about the central bank digital currency and Sundance over at theconservativetreehouse.com was talking about the central bank digital currency yesterday and had a few interesting points and insights that I thought would be worth sharing. He has a long article, the headline, From Beyond the Wire, The Information War, CBDCs, and a Metaphor for Those Who Need. He begins with a world map divided into yellow zones and gray zones. The yellow zones are the United States and Canada, nearly all of Europe, Australia and New Zealand, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. So essentially, the countries of the world still deeply enmeshed in that global regime system. They were the yellow zone. The rest of the world was the gray zone. And he has a discussion about how some of the technology is different. There are different currency systems developing, and that was part of the goal of the sanctions levied on Russia, the removal of Russia from SWIFT at the beginning of the conflict in Ukraine. He writes, the Russian sanctions were not created to block the Russians. The Russian sanctions were created to wall in the West. He says there are now networks of people who operate in various places that create proactive financial mechanisms for what you might call financial preppers. These people and groups set up bank accounts in foreign countries for you. They organize addresses, phone numbers, and create accounts that you can access that are outside the control of the dollar-based financial system. You can even get an official passport in the process. He's saying they sell hardware. They sell phone numbers that can be used on hardware that is not the same as the hardware we acquire in the yellow zones. They come with a different package of pre-installed software that allows the user of that phone to do different things, and the division is created along these geographical lines. He writes, how many people know that when you purchase one of these ghost phones, The data network automatically identifies the disparity when the phone crosses into the yellow zone, and shortly thereafter, the cellular network transmits a software update to bring the ghost phone into USA compliance. How many Americans know phone apps and internal app functions can exist on phones outside the yellow zone that do not exist inside the yellow zone? For example, use a ghost phone and you can access a digital wallet in Telegram. You can transmit funds to other Telegram users. However, use a USA compliant phone and you cannot. The function is there, but the service is quote unquote not available in your area. And he says all of this is about control at that technological level. He writes, technology is intertwined with central bank digital currencies. Tech companies are regulated by the U.S. and Western government, and the tech companies have to comply. The regulatory compliance is part of the process of control. There are regulatory walls around us that most do not understand. The same regulatory principle applies to finance and banking. Hence, the origination motive of the Yellow Zone Wall, built under the auspices of Russian sanctions. Let me make one point resoundingly clear before moving on. When the Western Central Bank digital currency system begins, all forms of cryptocurrency will be blocked and made unlawful inside the Western Zone, either by regulation or by legislation. Let me repeat this. Cryptocurrency in all forms will be banned. Now, if you are a Bitcoin person, particularly a Bitcoin maximalist, you would say, the same way that Second Amendment enthusiasts do, come and take it, fuck around and find out, and you can pry my Bitcoin from my cold dead hands or whatever the digital version of cold dead hands is. And that probably has something to do with Kara Swisher's metaverse avatar. That is probably the digital representation of cold dead hands. Now, Sundance is occasionally accused of blackpilling, and I believe that's for good reason. I have a lot of respect for him. I think he's a good researcher. I think he's a good analyst. I think he's missing a few things that would create more faith and hope. But then again, we are conspiracy theorists, and I can't prove to someone that they should believe otherwise. Reality is going to have to prove that or not on its own. He writes, crypto is not technically a currency. It is a barter based on trust. However, at a certain point, origination or end, crypto must have the ability to transfer into currency value. Dollars or another currency are needed to purchase Bitcoin, or Bitcoin eventually sold or exchanged for dollars or another currency. And he notes here he's only using Bitcoin as a familiar type of crypto. He says this process is where crypto gets blocked. Now, I don't believe that's how this is going to work out. And Bitcoin is not just representative of some crypto or all crypto. It's not just a familiar cryptocurrency. It is a particularly different cryptocurrency. And the SEC essentially just confirmed that again the other day. Ownership of crypto may not be unlawful, but any effort to use crypto as an alternate digital currency to exchange value will be unlawful once the dollar-based CBDC is launched. Again, this is the sort of thing that if it is widely adopted, they simply will not be able to stop unless they are going to go full, open, authoritarian, and regularly use state violence against the people to subdue the people, they're not going to be able to block these transactions unless they think they're going to control all phones, all transaction devices for all time, or make it so businesses would not be allowed to accept cryptocurrency as a form of payment. And again, I don't think there's any reason to believe this is how it's ultimately going to shake out. He is accurately describing their plans, but that doesn't mean that their plans are going to succeed, and I don't personally believe they stand any chance of being successful in these plans. The idea, for instance, that a Donald Trump administration is going to come in and ban cryptocurrency transactions, that sounds highly improbable. I would say impossible, but I guess it's possible that we are just wrong about absolutely everything. And in that case, hey, we're all screwed. But it's not like we're more screwed. If the regime wins, we're screwed no matter what. So what we need to do is focus on making sure that doesn't happen. But leaving that aside, he concludes his article with a strong metaphor that I think will be really helpful if you don't entirely understand where they're headed with all of this. So he's using a casino as a reference here. He says this is how it is currently. You go to the casino window and exchange $10,000 for poker chips valued at $10,000. You give the teller $10,000 in cash, banker's check, money order, a credit card or debit card transaction, and the teller gives you chips worth $10,000 in that casino. You can use the chips gambling and perhaps win more chips. Return to the window with $12,000 in casino chips, and the teller exchanges the chips for $12,000, cash or check or deposit, in your electronic card. You meet a man in the casino willing to give you his fancy Rolex watch in exchange for $5,000. You give the man $5,000 worth of your poker chips, and he gives you his Rolex watch. That man can then go to the teller window and exchange the chips for $5,000 in cash. You have the watch. Here's how it would be under the digital dollar, the central bank digital currency. You go to the teller window and produce your bank card containing a digital dollar balance. You exchange $10,000 worth of your digital dollars for $10,000 worth of poker chips. Except this time, with a digital dollar, each poker chip has your fingerprint on it. You spend or bet your poker chips, and each chip you win also arrives to you with your fingerprint on it. You win $12,000, you return to the window with $12,000 in chips, each with your fingerprint, and the teller uploads your card with $12,000 digital dollars. You meet a man in the casino willing to give you his fancy Rolex in exchange for $5,000. However, you cannot give the man your poker chips because they are unique to you and carrying your fingerprint. If he takes your fingerprint poker chips to the window, his fingerprint does not match the chip. His request for $5,000 in digital dollars would be denied. He cannot sell you his watch. Your transactional capability is limited by the digital fingerprint. He says, a digital dollar creates a unique ID attached to that digital dollar. Ultimately, the central bank that issues the digital dollar controls what the digital ID can do. That's you. And what those digital dollars can be used for. That's what you can do. Now, again, this is the exact problem that people believe Bitcoin can solve because it is decentralized and they will not be able to have that control mechanism over the currency. What Sundance is describing is them stepping back and taking the control over the devices you would use to use that currency in trades, in purchases. And again, this is one of those situations that necessitates the building out of parallel economies. That also means that progress needs to be made by the people in extracting themselves from the influence of government, even at the state and local levels, because that is who, generally speaking, is controlling the businesses. We saw in 2020 how states and cities, counties were targeting particular businesses, sometimes even churches, that tried to stay open. But with the businesses in particular, the state has the ability to threaten their business license. They can just take them out of business if they don't follow the orders. And that would be just another means of influence and control in the central bank digital currency environment. If they want to make sure that no one can use Bitcoin, one of the things they can do is regulate businesses, tell businesses, if you accept Bitcoin as payment for your goods or services, we're going to take your business license. That's one of those battles that's going to have to be fought that a lot of people just didn't have the motivation to fight in 2020, sadly. And because very few people had the courage to stand up to that, a lot of people ended up losing their businesses. People weren't willing to risk their business license, so instead, they just complied and lost their business anyway. Now, on Tuesday, we talked about the Baltimore Bridge disaster. We are told a container ship named the Dali after Salvador Dali. It had a twin ship named the Cezanne. Well, the Dali rammed into one of the support pillars of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, and the bridge collapsed. We are told it is just an accident. Yesterday, finally, the black box came out. So now we know exactly what happened. We have the official story from the authoritative source. And it's not only the authoritative source, it's the science. It's the real evidence behind what the authoritative source says. This is the New York Times with their latest updates. The headline, "Alarms and Order to Drop Anchor Recorded Before Ship Hit Bridge." Federal investigators said multiple alarms and an order to drop anchor could be heard on the data recorder of a massive cargo ship in the desperate moments before it struck a major Baltimore bridge early Tuesday, plunging the span and several construction workers into the cold river below. Drivers recovered the bodies of two workers from a red pickup sitting in 25 feet of water on Wednesday, officials said. The search for four other missing men was paused, with officials saying the bridge's twisted and jagged wreckage made it too dangerous to continue until the debris could be removed. Federal investigators said in a news conference Wednesday evening that they had reviewed 6 hours of audio from the ship's data recorder, which they hope they can use to help piece together details about the disaster. The harbor pilot directing the ship also had asked nearby tugboats for help in the tense moments before the crash, they said. The Biden administration pledged an aggressive effort to remove the bridge debris and reopen the port, which handles up to $200 million worth of cargo on a typical day. But Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg warned of a long and difficult path to full recovery, including the rebuilding of the mangled bridge, the Francis Scott Key. Officials said that shortly before the impact, the ship, a Singapore-flagged vessel called the Dali, suffered a complete blackout and issued a Mayday warning, prompting police officers to stop traffic at both ends of the bridge and averting a larger tragedy. And they have a transcript and the audio, supposedly, from that radio call to police, warning them of the potential for the boat to hit the bridge. And then they went and stopped traffic within 90 seconds. Apparently, they were just waiting down there at either end of the bridge. That's either way too coincidental or unbelievably fortunate in helping to avoid a larger tragedy. From the New York Post this morning, hazardous materials stored in 56 containers on cargo ship that toppled Baltimore Key Bridge, according to the Coast Guard. Dozens of containers on board the cargo ship have hazardous materials inside, with some having already spilled into the harbor waters, according to officials. The Singapore-based Dali tanker was carrying 56 containers laden with 764 tons of hazardous materials, including corrosives, flammables, and lithium-ion batteries. National Transportation Safety Board Chair Jennifer Homendy said in a briefing Wednesday. Some of the containers were quote-unquote breached, said Homendy, with authorities aware that some of the hazardous materials spilled into the Baltimore Harbor. They say the release of some of these hazardous materials created a sheen on the water, but the Coast Guard official stressed that most of the dangerous containers were unaffected by the crash and that there was, quote, no threat to the public. Well, that's good. A preliminary report from the NTSB should come out, they say, in 2 to 4 weeks, but the full investigation could take 12 to 24 months. CNN yesterday reported on the bridge accident, wanting to make sure that everyone understands ships hit bridges all the time. The headline, three ships have hit bridges in different countries in just 3 months. Should we be worried? Well, hey, maybe. But I'm just kidding. No, of course not. These are all accidents, as you've told us. So why would we be worried about accidents? They are just random, isolated incidents. They are not part of any larger problem, especially not one that would suggest any level of intentionality. Why would you even consider that, you conspiracy theorists? And then at the end of this article, CNN goes ahead and reminds us why, quoting the president of the Structural Engineering Institute of the American Society of Civil Engineers, Jerome Hajar, he says investing in infrastructure is critical for the public good, and it's critical to address those aging infrastructure. CNN writes, aside from improving old bridges for modern requirements, infrastructure needs to be upgraded to keep up with the latest progress in technology. This also according to Hajar. So you see, if new technology is created, we have to redo all the infrastructure. And because technology gets created so quickly now, that means we just need to keep recreating all of the infrastructure. And we need to do this actually worldwide. We need a sort of, like a Western version of a Belt and Road initiative like the Chinese communists are doing. We're going to call it Build Back Better. And the only thing we need to do to be able to build back better is, of course, have the sort of disaster that requires us to build back. And if we're going to do that continuously, if we need a lot of money, we're going to have a lot of disasters that allow us to access emergency funding, because these massive global infrastructure projects, well, they cost a lot of money. We have to pay off all sorts of people. You know how much money laundering is required to get that done? Wait. Just disregard that last 10 seconds. Just as there are advancements in other parts of the transportation industry, high-speed rail, autonomous cars, there are new developments in shipping and ports to adopt. It is critical to invest because of the advancements in technology and to keep our economy strong and progressive. So CNN just contacted the president of an engineering society so he could tell us why it's important that infrastructure spending keep up in its expansion with technological progress overall, because somehow that's necessary. They also quote a man who they describe as a professor of structural engineering at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and an expert on bridge collapses, saying he pointed to the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill passed in 2021, which includes $110 billion for roads, bridges, and major infrastructure projects. While the funding is welcome, CNN writes, it's far from the $4.5 trillion that studies have suggested are needed to upgrade American infrastructure to the target level of safety and efficiency. This is according to that professor. He says there are actually now more and more concerns about the future. Are we still going to do the same thing in 20, 30, 40 years? We can't, because if we do that, we can't expect different outcomes. So once again, disasters will continue until full compliance is achieved. You need to give them all of your wealth, your status, your power, your authority. Delegate all of the people's authority to this expert class. They are going to take care of everything. Unless you don't give them the power and the wealth and the decision-making capacity that they need, then everything is going to be a disaster and it will be your fault. But again, all of this is just a random occurrence, an accident, a disaster, yes, but truly accidental. There's obviously no intentionality behind any of this, but now that it's happened, it's a perfect opportunity to implement more of the agenda that was already being pushed for. Now, I know that's a conspiracy theory to suggest that they would want opportunities to build back better just because that's exactly what their agenda that is widely published and publicized. They hold conferences to relay that agenda. Despite the fact that the agenda calls for exactly that, they would never produce the disasters required intentionally. They just get to take advantage of when these disasters happen. Randomly, of course. And to remind you just how random it is, it's also random that the FBI published this press release on Monday. This is from FBI.gov. William J. Del Bagno, named special agent in charge of the Baltimore field office. Director Christopher Wray has named William J. Del Bagno, and I think that this is the Italian pronunciation of his name. It's spelled Del Bagno, but I'm pretty sure that's Del Bagno. As the special agent in charge of the Baltimore field office, Mr. Del Bagno most recently served as the acting assistant director of the inspection division at FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. Mr. Del Bagno joined the FBI as a special agent in 2005 and was assigned to the New York field office, where he conducted counterterrorism investigations. He also served on the Hazardous Evidence Response Team and became a certified Weapons of Mass Destruction Coordinator. In 2012, Mr. Del Bagno served temporarily as a supervisory special agent in the Chemical Countermeasures Unit of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Directorate at headquarters. In 2013, he was promoted to Unit Chief of the WMD Operations Investigative Unit. He became Assistant Section Chief for the WMD Investigations and Operations Section in 2014. So that is quite a history dealing with weapons of mass destruction, counterterrorism, and the Hazardous Evidence Response Team. He was placed in the Baltimore field office as the special agent in charge the day before the Baltimore Bridge disaster. Now, I'm totally open to that being just coincidence. It's just a rather remarkable coincidence. And there are many remarkable coincidences going on here. In fact, amazingly, the artist Salvador Dali actually has a painting called The Broken Bridge and the Dream. There is also this that may or may not prove relevant. This is from a website called The War Zone. It's TWZ.com, written by a military analyst named Joseph Trevithick. The headline, two of the fastest U.S. sea lift ships trapped by Baltimore bridge collapse. He writes, the vessels now stuck in Baltimore include the Algol class, SS Antares, and SS Denebola, both of which are part of the Ready Reserve Force fleet. The Transportation Department's Maritime Administration manages the RRF, that's Ready Reserve Force, and its ships are crewed by civilian merchant mariners. RRF ships fall under the control of the U.S. Navy's Military Sealift Command when they are activated for operations. The activation process for RRF ships, which are typically kept at a reduced operating status with a skeleton crew until called upon, can take between 5 and 10 days, depending on the vessel in question. He goes on, regardless, the current standing of the Antares and Denebola in Baltimore is especially notable. The pair represents a quarter of the entire Algol class, which, as already noted, are especially fast and otherwise capable cargo ships. He writes, later, Algol class have been called upon multiple times since they entered U.S. service. Just 5 of these ships were responsible for transporting 20% of U.S. cargo sent from the United States to Saudi Arabia during the first phase of Operation Desert Shield in the immediate run-up to the first Gulf War. The ships would go on to deliver 13% of all cargo that arrived in Saudi Arabia from the United States in the full course of that conflict. The U.S. military subsequently used Algols to support operations in Somalia and the Balkans in the early 1990s, as well as the opening phases of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in the early 2000s. So these things are basically workhorses in wartime. They deliver supplies across the world quickly and efficiently, and 2 out of the 8 ships are blocked in to Baltimore Harbor. And one more note from the article. This all comes at a time when U.S. military sealift capacity is in as high demand as ever, especially as the Department of Defense continues to focus its efforts on preparing for a potential high-end conflict in the Pacific against China. Sealift is also particularly relevant in light of the current security situation in Europe due to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and concerns about its potential to spill over elsewhere. The U.S. military has also used commercial cargo ships to help get aid bound for Ukraine, including M1 Abrams tanks and M2 Bradley infantry fighting vehicles, to intermediate staging points in Europe. U.S. sealift ships also continued to be available to help respond to humanitarian crises and other contingencies short of an actual conflict. The Bob Hope class Roy P. Benavidez, another RRF roll-on, roll-off cargo ship, is currently on its way to the Mediterranean Sea carrying equipment that will be used to establish a temporary offshore pier intended to help increase the flow of humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip. And there was some controversy over that just a few weeks ago. So again, this is one of those things. Is it just a coincidence? Is it information among other information? Is it a fact that just happens to be true that these ships are blocked in and that's all there is to it because the whole thing was an accident? I wouldn't suggest that the entire incident occurred to block these two ships in. But then again, if it is discovered that this was the result of some intentionality by an unknown party, then this could be a potential bonus, or it could have had something to do with the exact timing of the incident. Now, as of right now, we certainly don't have proof of intentionality, but that boat took a hard turn and went directly into the bridge support, at least to the extent that that video we saw is real and an accurate representation of what happened, and there is not more to it. We just don't know yet. Yesterday, there was a rumor going around on the internet that the ship was owned by the shipping company Foremost that is run by Angela Chow, who is Cocaine Mitch's wife's sister, the one who was reported to have died when her Tesla went backwards into a pond. Now, I tried to track that claim down yesterday and was not able to put that together. Angela Chow was certainly the CEO of Foremost Group, and they are involved in shipping. It's entirely possible that a connection is there, but I couldn't find it. I couldn't substantiate it. And there has also been a story about how the pilot of the ship was Ukrainian. And there is a website that suggests that might be true. It looks like it is some sort of shipping job placement firm where the pilot of this ship is listed as one of the people they work with. I'm not sure that means that he was actually captaining the ship at that moment. This might be one of those things where it seems like everything adds up, but it doesn't. I'm not saying either of these claims are false. I just don't personally think that they are substantiated enough to use them as building blocks for what I think actually happened. I mean, obviously, if the ship's pilot was a Ukrainian and somehow linked to Ukrainian intelligence or Ukrainian military, then there are a number of directions that you could pursue, including the potential justification for the passage of a spending package that might devote billions, hundreds of billions, maybe trillions of more dollars to infrastructure. Oh, we need to fix all this stuff now. Massive cash injection. Get this illegitimate Congress to pass plenty more spending to go out into the future, years in the future, so that people keep getting paid off, even though Donald Trump comes in as president. You can certainly create the scenarios, but right now that critical link isn't all that substantiated in my view. So to assume the rest would be, no pun intended, a bridge too far. Now, speaking of Ukraine and acts of terrorism, we haven't spent much time this week on the attack in Moscow last Friday, but since very early on in the process, Vladimir Putin has tried to lay the responsibility for that reported attack at the feet of the Ukrainians and the Kyiv regime controlled by the quote-unquote West that directs the action of those Ukrainians. Now, members of the fake administration have been saying since the beginning that there is absolutely no connection to Ukraine whatsoever. This is all ISIS. ISIS even said they did it. They took responsibility. They said it was because Russia was hostile to Islam. And this was all about Islamic fundamentalist terrorism. That's what ISIS is. Except that's not all ISIS is. ISIS was actually started and funded by good old Barack Hussein Obama. and ISIS was destroyed under Donald Trump. Now they have released a new brand of ISIS called ISIS-K. It's like cherry vanilla Coke, but terrorism. So Obama and Brennan and the CIA set up, fund, arm, run ISIS, destroyed and gone under Donald Trump. A few weeks ago, we get a report from the New York Times, a limited hangout, about how the CIA has been training, funding, arming, recruiting intelligence units, basically special forces units that carry out, quote unquote, their own ops. Sometimes those include acts of terrorism within Russia, but the CIA isn't responsible for any of those acts of terrorism. In fact, they are explicitly committed to not directing acts of terrorism by the Azov Battalion or any of the other organizations that they have set up, armed, funded, and run in Ukraine. Now, naturally, we don't know who to trust. You don't want to trust the Western media, and you don't want to trust Vladimir Putin with just whatever he says all the time either. But here is the Western media describing what Vladimir Putin thinks. This is Reuters Today. Russia links concert shooting to Ukrainian nationalists. U.S. says nonsense. Russian investigators said on Thursday they had found proof that gunmen who killed more than 140 people at a concert last week were linked to Ukrainian nationalists, an assertion immediately dismissed by the United States as baseless propaganda. Russia has said from the outset that it believes Ukraine was linked to the attack, even though Kyiv has denied it, and the militant group Islamic State has claimed responsibility. And of course, the normie mind says, why would ISIS take responsibility for this attack unless it was them who did it? Because we know that they're going to go after who did it, and they're going to go after ISIS if ISIS claims they did it. So why would ISIS claim they did it if they didn't do it? And well, normie, you're why they would do that. Because you will believe it's ISIS now till the end of your days. No matter what other proof is presented, no matter what actually comes out, no matter what actually happens, you will believe it's ISIS and not Ukraine because you love Ukraine, you support Ukraine, the very brave Ukrainians and their very sovereign borders. You've supported them the whole time. And you support the United States and the global regime because they're the ones who tell you they're looking out for you so you don't have to look out for yourself. And not looking out for yourself makes life so much easier. In a statement, Russia's investigative committee said for the first time that it had uncovered proof of a Ukrainian connection. While it described the nature of the alleged evidence, it did not publish it. As a result of working with detained terrorists, studying the technical devices seized from them, and analyzing information about financial transactions, evidence was obtained of their connection with Ukrainian nationalists, it said. It said there was confirmed data that the attackers had received significant amounts of cash and cryptocurrency from Ukraine. Another suspect involved in the terrorists' financing scheme had been detained, the committee said. White House National Security spokesman John Kirby described the Russian allegations as nonsense and propaganda and said Islamic State was solely responsible for the attack. In fact, the United States tried to help prevent this terrorist attack, and the Kremlin knows this. The United States had publicly warned earlier in March that it had intelligence that extremists were planning an imminent attack in Moscow. Kirby said it also provided written warning to Russian security services on March 7th at 11:15 a.m. Revealing the exact time of the alert appeared aimed at neutralizing Russia's charges against Ukraine. 3 days before the attack, Putin dismissed Western warnings of a potential extremist attack as blackmail. And if I was Vladimir Putin, I would probably see it that way too. If the global regime, if their representatives in the United States evil twin faction, the Uniparty, the regime's representatives in the U.S., currently represented by this fake administration and its spokespeople like John Kirby, if they, the people who I, Vladimir Putin, have watched direct terrorist attacks around the world for decades told me that they were concerned there might be a terrorist attack in my country, the very people I know, and they admit publicly all the time, are coordinating with Ukraine. And Ukrainian military, to the extent there is a Ukrainian military, Ukrainian intelligence, they're funding these people. They're giving them their intelligence. They're targeting where the Russian leaders are located for assassinations. They're sending weapons. They're rallying allies to oppose Russia. They're opposing Russian interests at the United Nations. They're doing everything they possibly can to wage war against Russia, including those sanctions, by the way. Those people are now telling me, Vladimir Putin, that there is going to be a terrorist attack by extremists in my country. Is that a warning or is that a threat? Now, I think all of this stuff is chess move against chess move. There is a current, ongoing public negotiation between these parties. The warning goes out. If you don't do XYZ, this is going to happen. The opposing party fails to comply. Therefore, this is going to happen. And it did. And now we are back in a familiar situation where there is an accusation made about U.S. involvement or British involvement in some act of terrorism or attack on infrastructure. And it is denied completely as if it is the most ridiculous conspiracy theory of all time. And then later on, it proves to be 100% true. We have also seen the U.S. with British intelligence and whatever Ukraine is attack critical infrastructure like the Crimean Bridge or like the Nord Stream pipeline, so we're told. We've seen them attack Russian ships. We have seen them use waterborne drones, or at least we've been told this has happened, waterborne drones to attack Russian ships. Now, could there be other attacks with waterborne drones? Sure there could. Were there? Who knows? But it's worth thinking about if some of those other pieces begin falling into place. But nonetheless, we are supposed to believe the fake administration when it says that they warned Russia just out of the goodness of their hearts. But let's close out this article. Russia says the fact that the U.S. was able to name the alleged perpetrator so fast is suspicious. The head of Russia's FSB security service said earlier this week, again without providing evidence, that he believed Ukraine, along with the U.S. and Britain, were involved. Western security analysts say the attack raised questions about the resourcing and priorities of Russian intelligence agencies that have been heavily focused on the Ukraine war and the need to stamp out opposition to it within Russia. Okay, so Russian intelligence is focused on stamping out opposition to their efforts in Ukraine within their own country, and they're so busy doing that that they just missed this attack despite the U.S.'s warnings. Yeah, that sounds like very accurate intelligence analysis. Now, whether or not it was actually Ukraine involved in those attacks that we assume happened as they've been reported, whether or not any of that is true, Russia is still using that attack as a justification for going harder after Ukraine, especially as they were already involved in a retaliation campaign based on a series of attacks from Ukraine into Russian territory. Aspects of the global regime have tried to spin this as Vladimir Putin being unable to keep his people safe. It was his brutal invasion, his war of choice and opportunity that has put his people at risk right after he was just once again reelected. Now, Ukraine and the West call that election illegitimate, and they claim that the people in the so-called Ukrainian territories who voted for Vladimir Putin in the Russian election, they were all coerced to vote in the Russian election. But of course, they still consider themselves Ukrainian, even though they are ethnically Russian and speak Russian and were the targets of an ethnic civil war in Ukraine for the last 10 years. Yeah, they're being coerced to vote for Putin in the Russian elections. All of that is illegitimate, but also, Volodymyr Zelensky, the comedic actor in Ukraine, his presidency is supposed to be coming to an end. They are supposed to have their elections this weekend, but they're not. They just canceled those elections. Why? Because of Putin's very brutal invasion. That means the regime can just hold on to power in Ukraine in the person of the comedic actor, or maybe they'll swap him out. Or maybe he already has no power at all, and it is just the military in control there. I mean, they were contesting Volodymyr Zelensky for power just a few weeks ago. But let's bring things back to the good old U.S. of A. Today, the nearly fully disgraced House Speaker Mike Johnson posted on X, formerly Twitter, "Together with the 11 House impeachment managers, I sent a letter to Senator Schumer telling him we'll deliver the articles of Secretary Mayorkas's impeachment to the Senate on April 10th and that he must hold a full trial. The American people deserve accountability." Oh, he must, huh? I'm sure that means he will. Here are the impeachment managers for the record: Mark Green, Michael McCaul, Andy Biggs, Clay Higgins, Ben Klein, Michael Guest, Andrew Garbarino, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Austin Pfluger, Laurel Lee, and Harriet Hageman. So that is your all-star team who's going to take down the big bad Alejandro Mayorkas. And if you believe that, you're going to have to prepare yourself for yet another rug to be pulled out from under your feet. Here is the letter dated today. "As Speaker and impeachment managers of the U.S. House of Representatives, we write to inform you that we will present to you, upon the Senate's return on April 10th, 2024, the duly passed articles of impeachment regarding Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. We urge you to schedule a trial of the matter expeditiously." Now, you got to wonder, in the Senate calculus, would it be good for the Uniparty and the regime to put our immigration problem on display and allow Alejandro Mayorkas to be the whipping boy, to be the fall guy, to take responsibility for the slave trade happening at the southern border? Would that create the momentum to pass the border security measures in the unipartisan compromise? Obviously, they're going to keep pushing for this funding and for the funding of those fake foreign proxy wars. Back to the letter. "On February 13th, 2024, the House of Representatives voted to impeach Secretary Mayorkas for high crimes and misdemeanors, including his willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law and his breach of the public trust. The evidence on both charges is clear, comprehensive, and compelling. And the House's solemn act to impeach the first sitting cabinet official in American history demands timely action by the Senate. It also deserves chuckles from virtually everyone. It took them 3 years, and they have impeached, with no chance of conviction, the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security in an illegitimate regime whose legitimacy they don't bother challenging. Now, for the record, if in this impeachment hearing we get more than just the immigration stuff, and we get into CISA and its role in elections and censorship, all of that under the Department of Homeland Security, and if we have some way to unwind some things all the way back to the beginning of DHS, back to the Patriot Act, back to 9/11, well, then maybe we could be in for a real treat, but I don't expect that to be the case. I'm not saying we'll never get there. It just doesn't seem like we're going to get there now, but I would love to be wrong. Back to the letter. "This methodical approach led us and the American people to the conclusion that Secretary Mayorkas' actions warranted impeachment. He refused to comply with the requirements of the immigration laws passed by Congress. In fact, he directed, through a series of memoranda, DHS employees to violate U.S. immigration laws. Consequently, the secretary is responsible for releasing millions of illegal aliens into the interior and creating unlawful mass parole programs. Throughout his tenure, he has repeatedly lied to Congress and the American people about the scope of the crisis and his role in it. His unlawful actions are responsible for the historic crisis that has devastated communities throughout our country, from the smallest border towns in Texas to New York City. The constitutional grounds for Secretary Mayorkas's conviction and removal from office are well-founded, and the historical record is clear. The framers of our Constitution gave Congress this authority for scenarios where executive branch officials, who are responsible for executing the laws passed by Congress, flout the law, substituting their own judgment for that of Congress. We call upon you to fulfill your constitutional obligation to hold this trial. The American people demand a secure border, an end to this crisis, and accountability for those responsible. To table articles of impeachment without ever hearing a single argument or reviewing a piece of evidence would be a violation of our constitutional order and an affront to the American people whom we all serve. And there is your preview of what will probably happen. Fox News essentially said the same thing today.
Well, Jillian, good afternoon. The Senate must at least launch a brief impeachment trial. The House narrowly impeached the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, in mid-February. So here's what's going to happen on Wednesday, April 10th. They are going to bring over the articles of impeachment and the House impeachment managers. These are the House members who serve as prosecutors to the case. They will be marched over kind of an entourage across the Capitol Rotunda to the Senate. And the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms Karen Gibson, she will announce the following. She will say all persons are commanded to keep silence on pain of imprisonment. Now, we just got a comment from the office of the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. He indicates that this is going to be probably at least a two-day trial because they will not swear in the senators as jurors until the next day. So that would be Thursday the 11th. And at that point, they can then move to dismiss. And keep in mind that Mayorkas is the first cabinet secretary impeached since the 1870s.
Oh, they're going to move to dismiss? And then they're just going to dismiss because there's no way that the Senate would possibly convict Alejandro Mayorkas and remove him from the illegitimate office in which he now sits? Well, doesn't that then kind of make it pointless for the House to have done that? And didn't these people like run on this sort of thing? Oh, we're going to hold them accountable. We're going to impeach Alejandro Mayorkas and we're going to impeach Joe Biden. But they're not going to impeach Joe Biden. And so what? They impeached Alejandro Mayorkas. We might not even get the trial. They might just move to dismiss. And again, I'm not trying to blackpill. I'm just saying this stuff is for show. If you listen to this show and you have for a while, you'll know I've been making this point for a very long time, and I have no reason to back down from that perspective whatsoever. I've said from the first moment Joe Biden became fake president that impeachment is not the way to remove a fake president. His illegitimacy must be shown to the nation, and he must be removed for that illegitimacy. He's not a duly elected legitimate president in the first place. Impeachment isn't the cure. And so, of course, it follows from that, that if that illegitimate president is appointing these people like Alejandro Mayorkas, then impeachment isn't the path to removal for him either. He is a product of Joe Biden's illegitimacy, which is a product of a stolen election and a usurpation of our nation and its federal government. All of that must be dealt with, and it doesn't get dealt with by an illegitimately elected Congress impeaching a cabinet member. I could get excited if I thought it was actually going to expose what the DHS actually does that is so detrimental to the average American man or woman, but there's no indication that's what we're going to get, and that letter didn't mention anything beyond immigration. So I wish I could be stoked for this, but I'm not. Because this seems like it is just a show to make it look like Republicans in Congress are actually doing something. But again, honestly, what are they supposed to do? They are not legitimately elected in the first place. We are being shown in full the illegitimacy of our government, the infiltration of that government, the deep state and administrative state that have usurped the constitutionally assigned responsibilities of the branches of government. We should be learning these lessons now, not getting our hopes up about things these illegitimate politicians who serve at the behest of the Uniparty, what they might do for us. They're not going to do anything for us. Anything you think they are doing for us, they are doing for them, and they have sold successfully to you, and that is it. If that makes you feel powerless, it shouldn't, because people are starting to realize that fact. And once enough people realize that fact, that's when something can actually be done about it. And so let's discuss the depth of their illegitimacy. This is from Reuters yesterday. Pennsylvania can discard undated mail-in ballots, U.S. Appeals Court rules. A U.S. Appeals Court on Wednesday rejected a challenge to a Pennsylvania rule that allowed the state to discard mail-in ballots that arrive on time, but in envelopes with missing or incorrect dates written on them by voters. Voting rights advocates said the Philadelphia-based 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals 2-1 ruling in favor of Republicans could allow for thousands of ballots to be discarded that are cast by voters in Pennsylvania, a key battleground state in the upcoming November presidential election. Several advocacy groups, including the Pennsylvania State Conference of the NAACP, had sued in 2022 to challenge a state requirement that counties reject mail-in ballots with a missing or wrong date written on their envelopes. Litigation over Pennsylvania's mail-in ballot rules was also a feature of the 2020 presidential election, in which Republican then-President Donald Trump lost the state to Democratic challenger Joe Biden. Democrats actively used mail-in voting in 2020, helping Biden win the state over Trump by some 80,000 votes. Biden will face Trump again in November's elections. And of course, in Pennsylvania, Donald Trump was up by hundreds of thousands of votes at the end of election night. And then, by the next morning, Joe Biden had won. But it wasn't election fraud. The election wasn't stolen. You can't prove it. There's no proof of that anywhere. They're baseless claims. There's no evidence. Didn't you see all the court decisions? Didn't you hear Bill Barr? Didn't you hear Chris Krebs? The election is totally free and fair, safe and secure. The reported results accurately reflect the will and intent of the voter. Except, you know, there's also that thing where the courts have decided multiple times that Pennsylvania's elections were held in an unconstitutional manner. This is just further proof of that. They already found the same thing in Wisconsin as well. We all pretend that that doesn't matter because Joe Biden is still serving as fake president. But here's the thing. It does matter. Let's continue with the article. In 2022's midterms, more than 10,000 ballots were discarded in Pennsylvania, based on what the voting rights group said were inconsequential paperwork errors in violation of a provision of the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964. The law, enacted to protect Black and other minority voters, has a materiality provision that prohibits denying someone the right to vote just because of an error on paperwork. And of course, that's how voting rights advocates would frame this. These aren't fake, generated mail-in ballots that are being flooded into the system at the last minute so they can make up for any possible deficit and achieve the results that the computers say they've achieved. This is for when old Black ladies make small mistakes on their ballots. The mean Republicans are trying to make sure they're not allowed to vote. That's what's really happening. Those mean Republicans, they're not worried about elections being held constitutionally and according to the law. They're actually just trying to make sure that old Black ladies aren't allowed to vote. At some point, you would hope that that is the sort of notion that the nation as a whole could really become too smart to accept. But we're not there yet, so I guess everybody's still racist. Back to the article. A lower court judge last year agreed that the state requirement violated the materiality provision, prompting an appeal by the RNC and other Republican groups defending the state requirement. In Wednesday's ruling, U.S. Circuit Judge Thomas Ambrose, an appointee of Democratic former President Bill Clinton, said the materiality provision only applies when a state is determining who may vote and not to the rules governing how they may do so. In other words, its role stops at the door of the voting place, Ambrose wrote in an opinion joined by U.S. Circuit Judge Cindy Chung, an appointee of Democratic President Joe Biden. U.S. Circuit Judge Patty Schwartz, an appointee of Democratic former President Barack Obama, dissented, saying the ruling would allow Pennsylvania to, quote, toss a ballot cast by a qualified voter based on mistakes on required paperwork immaterial to determining voter qualifications, end quote. Now, they're framing it all as the markings made on the ballot by a voter. But that's not the only reason why we wouldn't want undated mail-in ballots to be accepted, particularly not when states say, well, we need an extra week after Election Day to see if more ballots come in. We don't want them getting stuck in the mail. So you've got that piece. But then you've got the Facebook drop boxes, the ballot drop boxes everywhere, where ballots can just be dumped in after Election Day, collected. There's not going to be a postmark on them because they don't go through the post office. And then because no one is actually complying with chain of custody requirements in their elections, do we just pretend those ballots are the same as late arriving, quote unquote, mail-in ballots, and they must be accepted regardless of any date on them? And it would be one thing if cases like these were isolated, but they're not isolated. They're part of a pattern. And the argument from the quote unquote voting rights activists and advocates always ends up supporting the side that says we can allow any ballots into this process, any ballots that we can get our hands on, those count. There are no restrictions. We don't have to follow the laws about any of it. And you got to think about that, because we are told that these elections, as complicated and convoluted as the process is, the total lack of transparency to the voter, with all of that, we are told it is the following of these laws that makes our elections legitimate, that gives our elections integrity. Yes, the process is complicated, it's convoluted, but that's just because we have so many voters that we need to get that count done as fast as possible. That's why we put in the machines. And hey, if we don't know the actual results for years, who cares? Because we'll just certify the results we generate and we'll put these people in office and then the people will have no recourse. It doesn't matter. The laws are in place, which means the system has integrity. And if we don't follow the laws, well, you're not allowed to complain or else you are destroying our democracy. Let's close this out. Ari Savitsky, a lawyer for the voting rights groups at the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, in a statement said they are, quote, considering all of our options at this time, end quote, which could include an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. By all means, please, please do that. Please have the U.S. Supreme Court decide in front of the nation whether or not states have to follow their constitution and their election laws. Let's please have that argument in front of absolutely everybody, and the case can be made to the nation by these voting rights and civil rights activists and advocates that election laws don't need to be followed. As complicated and convoluted as our processes are, don't even bother following the rules, the only rules that might prevent election manipulation and election fraud. Don't even bother following them. Those are just guidelines. They're not actually requirements. That is the argument they are making to us. And if you don't accept their argument, you are racist. The decision was one of several court rulings nationally on Wednesday that could shape upcoming electoral contests. A federal court upheld Florida's congressional map, rejecting a lawsuit claiming it discriminated against black voters. And of course, we are still waiting to hear what the Supreme Court is going to decide on whether or not they will hear arguments in the lawsuit brought by Kerry Lake and Mark Fincham, as the exposure of our stolen elections continues, though too slowly for all of our tastes, I'm sure. Now, we talked yesterday about Pat Philbin, the White House counsel, who claimed that he led the charge in getting members of the Department of Justice to commit to resigning if Donald Trump went and made Jeffrey Clark the acting attorney general so that he could pursue claims of election fraud following the 2020 election. Well, another man involved in that was Dr. John Eastman, a prominent constitutional attorney. He has been fighting for his right to continue practicing law in disbarment hearings in California. He published a Substack today titled California Bar Ruling. It is not long, and I think it's good to know what's going on with John Eastman. After an investigation that started 2.5 years ago when a leftist advocacy organization filed a bar complaint against me, And after 6 months of my responding to the Barr investigators' demand for information letters, and after a 10-week trial that one commentator bet was the largest and most expensive in Barr discipline history, the California Bar Court judge has issued her ruling, during Holy Week no less, recommending that I be disbarred because, she asserts, I made misrepresentations of hotly disputed facts and unresolved questions of constitutional law in my representation of former President Trump and his challenges to the illegality of the 2020 election. And because I also made those claims in public speeches, writings, and media appearances in which I highlighted illegality in the election, all of which is constitutionally protected speech. The ruling is here, and he links to the ruling. My closing argument brief, responding to every false allegation the bar attorneys leveled against me, is here, and he links to that as well. He also includes a link to his response to the bar's citation of a doctored quotation from a court opinion, just one of the many false claims they made, according to Eastwood. He says, astoundingly, the court repeated that doctored quotation in the opinion. He writes, over the coming days and weeks, I will be highlighting the evidence that demonstrates the contrary of the findings of misrepresentation made by the court, and also the aspects of the trial that were simply beyond belief. News coverage of the 10-week trial, particularly that by Rachel Alexander at the Arizona Sun-Times and in her Twitter feed, was extensive, and she is great at following these Arizona court cases. He also links to his crowdfunding GiveSendGo website and the trial transcripts, and you can find all of this at johneastman.substack.com. He also says, we will appeal the decision, of course, and hopefully the California Bar Review Court, the California Supreme Court, or the U.S. Supreme Court will step in to put a stop to this lawfare that has become a serious threat to the First Amendment, the right of controversial clients and causes to legal representation, and more broadly to our adversarial system of justice. Eastman was on War Room this morning, and I will share that with you. The clip is a little long, 6 minutes or so. And then I'm going to wrap up the episode. So if you've already heard this, if you've watched it in the info stream on Telegram, t.me/veryreasonable, but one way or another, give him a listen.
We streamed on our Getter, our other Getter channel, what we didn't cover live on the show, your entire, I think it would, correct me if I'm wrong, was it 35 days? Was this hearing 35 days long or about 30, took about over a month? Am I correct in that?
32 days over 10 weeks. The most expensive and longest bar disciplinary proceeding in history, as one commentator speculated. It was an outrage.
So our audience, you have tens of thousands of people that were there the entire time. And of course, there was tremendous commentary by Rachel Alexander over at the Arizona, I think, Sun-Times, Michael Patrick. Like, incredible. We would have them on. People would watch it. We had lawyers watch it. It was pretty outrageous. The report to the judge, you said the judge then issued. So we saw in there that this was a complete total witch hunt. Unbelievable stuff was done. But are you saying then the judge doubled down this report? Are you saying this 128-page report has a lie on every page, sir?
Just about. I've read it through quickly the first time, but I mean, it's just stunning. You know, and she acknowledges that she blocked numerous of our witnesses and much of our evidence, including a major post-election assessment that had been done by a professional CPA named Joseph Fried, who said there's no way this election should have been certified. She prohibited that from coming in because he didn't publish it until January of 2023, even though it was based on the same evidence that we had before us in December of 2020. And yet, shortly thereafter, the bar lawyers offered a report that had been done down in Arizona, paid for by the government, that, you know, surprisingly said the government's running of the election was perfect. And she let that in because it was a government report, or paid government paid report. One of the issues, the charges against me, is that by filing a motion to intervene on behalf of President Trump that incorporated Texas's own complaint, that I acted unreasonably as an attorney by incorporating that complaint. We offered into evidence the briefs of six state attorney generals who did exactly the same thing, because the issue is whether any reasonable attorney would have taken the actions I did. She said their briefs are not relevant, even though they did exactly the same thing I did, which demonstrated that reasonable attorneys were taking these actions. She said it was not relevant to the case. These are the kind of things that we dealt with throughout the 10 weeks, and that will be a major focus of our appeal. But the other thing that will be a focus of our appeal is, I mean, several of the counts against me, you know, include claiming that I made false statements in public, including on your show, Steve. This is such vintage protected First Amendment rights stuff. And she says, well, lawyers aren't allowed to make misrepresentations. Of course, the claims of misrepresentations are themselves false. My favorite of them was one of the charges against me said, I claimed on January 6th in my speech before the lips that dead people voted, which was true. And they acknowledge it in the paragraph. The Michigan Inspector General admitted 1,500 dead people voted. And they said my claim was false. And the judge said it was false because what I really meant by that was more dead people voted than were necessary to affect the outcome of the election. Of course, I never said any such thing. Another example of the falsity that we called them on. They falsely claimed that the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals had upheld the constitutionality of the Electoral Count Act. That was not true. The issue never even got to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. The case they were citing was the D.C. District Court, which doesn't have any precedential force. And the case didn't involve the Electoral Count Act at all. It involved completely different state election laws. The quotation was doctored to make it appear as though the case said something that it didn't say. We called them on that in a responsive pleading. And yet the judge repeated that doctored quotation as if it was true in her opinion.
Can we hold you through the break? Because Mike Davis is going to join us. I want to make sure that we've got plenty of time with you in this. Because Mike Davis get commentary and get you back. Here's the question on a general basis. Starting in the 1930s, first in Moscow with the Bolsheviks, and then later with the fascists, with the Nazis in Germany, the rule of law and judges, I mean, completely flipped and was as used as probably the key instrument of state power. Suppression of people's rights, freedom, and we saw what happened there. You know, you had the Nazi judges and people seeing the black and white newsreels of what they did, and also the Moscow show trials. When we sat there for the 32 days and saw what happened live in court where they couldn't hide, and now you have this report with all these lies and misrepresentations, how are we then to see as citizens that the radical left is going down the same path? We see what's happening to President Trump, but yours in particular, where there's such blatant misrepresentations, lies, and then using procedure against you, sir.
Well, it's a problem, and one only hopes that the upper courts that will consider this on appellate review will step in and fix this problem, because it's a travesty. I mean, what the essence of the ruling is that the government has spoken, and you know, we said the election was the most secure in history. That there wasn't any evidence of fraud. These are the things that they said. And because I kept offering evidence that there was, I must be lying. This is Orwellian. It's authoritarian. The government has spoken, and you better bow to our claims or we're going to destroy you. This is not the America that we grew up in. This is not the America that our founders bequeathed to us. And by God, I'm going to fight with everything I've got to make sure that we fix this problem before we pass the baton to the next generation.
And we are supposed to believe that it is John Eastman who is destroying our democracy. I'll be back tomorrow at the same reasonable time on the same reasonable podcast network. I don't have a network. Masks and lockdowns don't work. They lied to you about a pandemic, and Joe Biden will never be president.
In my mind, that's the end game.
If you're listening to this episode for free, you can support me and support the show and the work I do by signing up for a paid subscription at imyourmoderator.substack.com. You can do so for as low as $50 a year or $5 a month. Comes out to under a quarter per episode, and you'll blast right through the paywall for all of the writing. The merch store is www.cancelcouture.com, and you can find everything else by heading to Linktree. Linktree.com/I'mYourModerator. And I'll see you soon out on the range.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
In my mind, that's the end game.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to follow what I'm reading and thinking throughout the day, you can do that by downloading the Telegram Messenger app and going to t.me/I'mYourModerator. On social media, you can follow me on Truth Social, Getter, and Gab at I'm Your Moderator. I also have channels on Rumble and BitChute. If you'd like to follow the writing, you can find me at imyourmoderator.substack.com. The merch site is cancelcouture.com, or go direct shop.spreadshirt.com/cancel-couture. If you'd like to support the podcast financially, the best place to do that is Ko-Fi. Go to ko-fi.com/I'mYourModerator. And all of these details will appear in the show notes with each episode. I'll see you soon down on the range.
It's happening!